Christmas. I don't want to fight tonight with.
This week, we spotted the rarest of beasts in Washington, D.C., a bipartisan moment, and just in time for the holidays.
Just proves that when people trust each other, you can sit down and get legislation that's good for the country.
Although it was a difficult negotiation session, what we came out with in the end was a good bill.
A brand new approach to dealing with narcotics in this country, and a new approach when it came to dealing with prisoners in our country. It is a breakthrough.
Merry Christmas.
On Tuesday, the Senate overwhelmingly passed one of the most significant changes to the country's criminal justice system in decades. The bipartisan First Step Act improves conditions for prisoners, expands programs to decrease recidivism, and perhaps most notably, reforms sentencing. It comes decades after Congress implemented draconian drug laws and sentencing around crack and cocaine that disproportionately incarcerated poor Americans and Americans of color. And it also led to an explosion of the prison population in the United States.
We were scared to death of crack cocaine, which was now showing up all over America. We created a 100-to-1 disparity between crack cocaine and powder cocaine sentencing. The net result of that, we thought, would be to scare America straight in terms of the danger of this drug, and it backfired.
Democratic Senator Dick Durbin was one of the major forces behind the bill, along with Republican Senators Mike Lee of Utah and Chuck Grassley of Iowa, the Senate Judiciary Committee chairman. So where are we now? That's the first question on The Takeaway. Inamai Chatiyar is director of the Justice Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, and she joins me live in the studio. Inamai, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So first off, what are the broad strokes of this Criminal Justice Reform Act?
So the First Step Act basically does three things. So one, it improves prison conditions, which are very inhumane. Second, it has an ability for prisoners to participate in specific programming and then earn their way toward shorter sentences and early release. And then third, and most importantly, it actually has very robust federal sentencing reform. So it reduces mandatory minimums for certain drug crimes and then allows judges to depart from those mandatory minimums in certain cases.
So let's go back for a second to the conditions that led to the need for this, which we sort of touched on in the introduction here. Lawmakers who were announcing the bill cited the war on drugs. I recall it. I've lived through it. For those who didn't, what was that? Tell us what happened there.
So in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, lawmakers across the country, Democrats and Republicans in Washington and in states, enacted very draconian, harsh criminal laws and sentencing laws that not only increased criminal penalties, but also made sentences dramatically long. And that has resulted in the United States being the largest incarcerator in the world. So we have 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prisoners. And the prison population is disproportionately black and brown people.
So the thing that was most, I think, interesting for a lot of folks was that this was a bipartisan effort. And I'm wondering, how did we get to this bipartisan effort? What was it that prompted these parties to work together?
So the politics on this issue are actually very fascinating. So in about 2007, some Republicans in states, particularly starting in Texas, due to the fiscal crisis and the state budget crunch, started looking at ways to reduce the prison population. So Texas was the first state to do that. It was bipartisan, but it was Republican-led. And then that went state by state. And then we saw a very small decrease in the prison population based on that. And so in about 2015, this effort came to Washington, where you had Dick Durbin and Chuck Grassley introduced the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. And there was a strong bipartisan coalition around that bill. It ended up actually not passing, mainly due to Jeff Sessions and Tom Cotton, who were very against the idea of releasing prisoners.
So we know now the Sessions is obviously no longer in that role. So was that one of the stopgaps that was removed, you think, to really move this forward?
I think that was part of it. So after that bill died, then you had the president enter into office and appoint Attorney General Sessions. And they used a lot of really terrible crime rhetoric. And so I think people were unsure about where this administration was going to go. And at some point, you had Jared Kushner, who was very dedicated to this cause, come in and really talk to the president about the need for criminal justice reform. Because Jeff Sessions was there, it seemed that sentencing reform was a non-starter. But once he did leave, I don't think it was a coincidence that sentencing reform was then included into this bill.
I also want to ask a question. You mentioned Jared Kushner, but there's also, and this is not a joke, Kim Kardashian has met with the president a couple of times to discuss clemency and getting folks out of long-term sentencing. So do you think that also played into this? I mean, just the fact that this is becoming a bigger issue outside of politics?
I think so. I mean, I think that the idea of people like Kim Kardashian, who have a lot of public power to be talking about this, is very important. I think there was a very concerted effort to push the president through her, through Jared, even through people like the Koch brothers, who were really pressuring the president.
And let's talk a little bit about this. We're talking about federal system, not state and local jails. Is that right?
Right. So about 85% of prisoners are at the state level. So this doesn't affect them. However, to have this play out in Washington in this bipartisan way really helps create the public and political support for states to go further.
And is there an expectation that states will go further now that they've seen this at the federal level?
I think that's what we're hoping. And I do think that you will see that playing out. I mean, one thing to note on that is this bill, which provisions were considered moderate in 2016, is now being labeled Trump's criminal justice reform bill. So
which is good for the president.
Which is good for the president, but also really good for the cause, because that means that politicians can't be offering these types of proposals if they're trying to be progressive or reform-minded. So I do think you will see politicians trying to make broader changes at the state level.
Inamai Chatiyar is director of the Justice Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
For Washington, D.C., the First Step Act could have an especially big impact. Tony Lewis Jr. is an activist and author based in D.C. and an expert on reentry. Tony, thanks for joining the show.
So happy to be here. Thank you.
So what is it about Washington, D.C. That makes it unique for people in the criminal justice system?
In D.C., we do not have a state-run or city-run prison system. So the Federal Bureau of Prisons becomes the destination for any individual that breaks a local law or a federal law. So that makes us the only place in America where if you commit a local crime, you do your sentence in the Federal Bureau of Prisons.
Now, when you heard about the First Step Act, were there specific parts of that act that you thought would directly influence D.C.?
What jumped out at me the most was the 500-mile radius recommendation. Like I said, all of the D.C. inmates are in the federal system, so therefore they can be all across the country. I remember growing up, my father, when he first went to prison in 89, his first 13 years of his sentence, he was in a place called Lompoc, California, which is 3,000 miles away. So I thought about the families here in D.C. that would at least have their loved one to be in a 500-mile drivable range from Washington. So that made me excited. Though 500 miles is still pretty far for a poor family, it's closer than being in California or Louisiana or New Mexico, Colorado, etc.
Tony, what's the importance of proximity?
Yeah, I always tell people to just think about the people that you love and imagine if they were thousands of miles away and you couldn't get to see them and what that would do. And we all know that familial bonds as it relates to inmates are very important with inmate behavior and, more importantly, recidivism. People that are connected to their families tend to do better when they return to the community. They want those familial bonds help motivate them and help them want to change their lives. So the more we can maintain those bonds and keep people connected, the better chances we have of impacting recidivism.
And of course, one of the things that this is also trying to address is reentry. What happens after a person comes out of the criminal justice system? Was there anything in the bill that stood out to you about reentry, or was there something missing?
Well, I do like the fact that we're going to expand training and education, but in what is my question? I think we need to really target growth industries. Working in reentry, I don't see people coming home from the federal system with up-to-date skill set, a skill set that can make them competitive. So when we talk about successful reentry, we know that having an in-demand skill is paramount.
Are you thinking about efforts like Ban the Box, which was something that was really popular and at least had somewhat bipartisan support a couple of years ago? Or are you thinking about other things that could be done?
Sure. Ban the Box was, again, like this bill, a good first step, but it doesn't necessarily do the job because people still have to get a background check at some point. And I'm not saying do away with background checks, but what I am saying is that we have to have a more comprehensive hiring process that looks at people on a case-by-case basis. No blanket, no felony provisions. We have to have people look at individuals and the steps that they've taken since they made their crime. And also we have to look at rational relationship between crime and job that they're applying for and have those factors play a part in the consideration of hiring individuals. And I really think we can't go to the business community at the end. We have to have them as a part of this conversation from the beginning.
Were you encouraged by the fact that this had both Democrat and Republican support?
Yes. I was very happy that there was some bipartisan collaboration. But what I will say is this, when we talk about some, particularly the sentencing reforms that went into this bill, and only one of those sentencing reforms being retroactive around the crack cocaine disparity, which will bring about 3,000 individuals home, which is a great achievement. But I feel like those other reforms need to be retroactive as well. If we have bipartisan support that things are wrong around sentencing, if it's wrong today, it was wrong then. So there are people languishing in jail for the last, you know, two or three decades that would not be sentenced to life without parole if they were sentenced today based on this bill. So I think we can't really worry about what it's going to do to the judicial system or how it's going to hold up the courts. If we have to appoint more judges, then we should do that. But I think we have to truly be committed to undoing the wrongs of our justice system.
Tony Lewis Jr. is an activist and an expert on reentry and the author of Slug, A Boy's Life in the Age of Mass Incarceration. Tony, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. Have a wonderful holiday.
The decision to withdraw an American presence in Syria is a colossal, in my mind, mistake, a grave error that's going to have significant repercussions in the years and months to come.
That's Republican Senator from Florida Marco Rubio on Wednesday responding to President Trump's order to completely withdraw the 2,000 American ground troops in Syria.
We've been fighting for a long time in Syria. I've been president for almost 2 years, and we've really stepped it up, and we have won against ISIS.
But lawmakers and top officials disagreed with that assessment of defeat, and the move reportedly blindsided both the Pentagon and the State Department. Nancy Youssef is a national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and she's been following the developments. Nancy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
So this was a surprise to the president's own national security team. I'm going to ask you why that is. Was this an off-the-cuff tweet?
So it just didn't go through, from what we can tell, the normal interagency process in which all the relevant agencies get together and offer their perspectives and lay out what a withdrawal plan would look like and what are the possible implications and how does one mitigate against that. Rather, it seems that this was sort of talked about amongst a small group of people. The military was included at some point in that discussion and was notified before yesterday's announcement and had a chance to communicate within their ranks. But I don't think it really made its way through the Pentagon very low, if that makes any sense. And so in that regard, most people were caught off guard, particularly since General Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had just said a few weeks ago that the U.S. still had a lot of work to do in Syria to leave it in such a way that groups like ISIS could not return.
There seems to also be, in addition to that, there are confusion. There also seems to be competing narratives here. As recently as last week, the American envoy to the Coalition Against ISIS told reporters, and I'm quoting here, "We want to stay on the ground and make sure that stability can be maintained in these areas." How does that square, Nancy, with what the president just said?
So I think what the president is signaling is that he considers ISIS defeated because the physical caliphate, the state that it had established, has all but dissipated. And what you're hearing from people like General Dunford and the special envoy is that ISIS isn't defeated until there are local forces on the ground that can stop its reemergence or something like it from reemerging, that the sort of fundamental elements that allowed it to create a state are addressed. And so I think that's the distinction one is hearing when the president says ISIS is defeated and some of those within his administration are arguing that it still has a ways to go.
There's another competing narrative here. The president tweeted this morning that Russia was not happy with the U.S. pulling out of Syria. But Russian President Vladimir Putin said today, and I'm quoting, "If the decision to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria was made, then it is a correct one." Again, what's going on with those competing narratives?
Syria was in part a proxy war for regional influence. Remember that Russia has a major naval base in Syria. It had supported Bashar al-Assad. It was of the conviction that his continued rule would lead to more stability than having essentially uncertainty about who would govern this very sort of diverse country. And so the thinking from some was that with the U.S. withdrawal, Russia's ability to influence events on the ground would increase, given that it wouldn't have to compete in terms of influence, and even on a practical level, no longer have to deconflict with the U.S. military in terms of strikes within Syria. Now, the counter argument is that by leaving, Syria becomes essentially Russia's problem, not one that's sort of divided among major powers. And so I think that's why you're hearing conflicting ideas about what this means for Russia.
I'd like to talk a little bit about who wins, if you will, and who loses if the United States goes through with this plan. Let's start with the 2,000 troops that are currently on the ground in Syria. What would it mean for the region if those troops are set to leave within 30 days as the president had ordered?
So I think the most immediate impact is on Kurdish forces, particularly members of what was called the Syrian Democratic Forces, a sort of conglomerate of local Kurdish and Arab fighters, because they were essentially the local fighting force on the ground. They were who the airstrikes were in support of and were at the front lines of some of the most critical battles. And so one could argue that they're in a very, very vulnerable position now. I think regionally, and I'm looking at this because I'm a Pentagon reporter from a U.S. military perspective, the concern about the U.S. withdrawing immediately from a Pentagon perspective is the military takes its partnerships with local forces very seriously, and there was always a accusation that the relationship between the Kurds and the U.S. was sort of a marriage of convenience, for lack of a better term. And so when the U.S. says it's going to withdraw so quickly, I think there's a real concern that it will threaten future partnerships between U.S. and local forces on the ground, that it'll feed the perception that the U.S. is not a long-term partner, but a transactional one.
And there's also, most recently, the president, President Trump, should I say, took to Twitter again to repeat his view that the United States should not be, quote, policemen of the Middle East. How does this move fit in with his overall foreign policy strategy?
So it's a great question, because it becomes a question of what's a policeman and what's protecting U.S. interests, right? One could argue that the U.S. wasn't in Syria to police Syria, but to keep it, the eastern part of, in particular, from becoming a safe haven from which terror groups could plan attacks on the U.S. and its allies. And so the other concern was that Syria would be a means through which Iran, which this administration sees as a foe, could foment and spread its sort of influence in the region. And so to the question of the U.S. foreign policy, on one hand, it suggests that the United States believe that it no longer needs to sort of have troops overseas to prevent attacks, that its presence overseas doesn't necessarily mitigate against terror groups forming and plotting attacks overseas. On the other hand, it's a little confusing, I think, for some, because just a few weeks ago, the U.S. was really aggressively pushing Iran as a major national security threat, and yet its withdrawal from Syria allows Iran to exploit that vacuum and expand its influence into the region and possibly threaten countries like Israel.
Nancy Youssef is a national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Nancy, thank you.
My pleasure.
Go to OmahaSteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut aged-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to OmahaSteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
Amy Walter here, host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. You might know me from the PBS NewsHour or the Cook Political Report, and now I get to host a political podcast from The Takeaway. I hope you'll check it out. Just search for Politics with Amy Walter in your podcast app and subscribe. It's as easy as that.
In Minneapolis, the unemployment gap between white and black residents is the highest in the nation. And when it comes to income, home ownership, and health outcomes, in almost every measurable way, life is generally worse for black residents than white ones. But as part of a new ambitious plan, Minneapolis is hoping that changing residential zoning laws could be part of a solution to help close that gap. Here to explain is Max Nesterak, a reporter and producer with Minnesota Public Radio. Max, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. So this is the 2040 plan for Minneapolis. What is it that they're trying to do by undoing rezoning laws?
So they're really trying to do two things. One, they're trying to work towards climate change, decreasing carbon emissions. And the second thing they're trying to do is close racial disparities, like you mentioned in the intro there. And I should also mention, Minneapolis has the highest homeownership gap between black and white residents in the country. 75% of white people here own their own homes. 25% of black residents do. And so what they're looking to do is saying, you know, if we're going to have a lot more residents over the next 10, 20 years, how can we make sure that our city grows as equitably as possible? And so that's why they came up with this triplex plan, you know, having up to 3 units on any parcel of land throughout the entire city. That's really getting national attention because we're the first major city to so-called abolish single-family home zoning.
Which had some opponents and some supporters, is that right?
Correct. Like anywhere people love their single family homes, and you would see a lot of resistance among people who had lived in their homes for a long time. So older, whiter, wealthier people who bought into a neighborhood that was mostly single family homes and they want to keep it that way. But city planners said, you know, we have 35,000 more people expected to be here over the next 20 years. And we either have to build up or out. And in the city proper, you know, there's nowhere else to build. There are no green fields. So, and traditionally what's happened is you would put denser housing in poor neighborhoods, or you would build luxury apartments in downtown or elsewhere. And so they're saying, what is a more equitable way of growing up? And to do that, they're letting basically any homeowner build 2 more units on their plot of land.
Now, here's the thing, though. It's not saying that the homes that are currently there have to be changed. It's just, are the homeowners who are currently there worried that by increasing the density of their neighborhoods, that might decrease the value of their single-family homes?
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, the other concern is they think that homes next to theirs are going to be bulldozed and 3-unit apartment buildings are going to be put up. And, you know, for people living in New York or Chicago, that may not seem like a big deal.
But you read my mind, Max. I was just going to say, I've got
right,
80 stories going up down the block, but yes.
Right. But, you know, in Minneapolis, the vast majority of land here is single family homes. And like that's similar to most big cities in America.
Well, like I said, we've got about 80 stories on all these buildings here, so we'll be interested to see how this plays out. Max Nesterak is a reporter and producer with Minnesota Public Radio. Thanks so much, Max.
Thank you.
I think kindness is a way of being.
Most things that are done out of kindness is basically done out of love.
I think it's a behavior, a skill. It's glue. It's essential.
Kindness.
Tonight, an act of kindness at a rental car company in Tulsa goes just viral.
One really big random act of kindness.
Kindness is caring enough about others that we treat them with gentleness, graciousness, and generosity.
New tonight, a police officer's random act of kindness isn't going unnoticed.
Good and generous and sacrificing.
Once you start being kind to people, they feel better and it just spreads.
Commuting, especially in urban areas, can be, well, tough. Commutes are long, people are tired, and a lot of the time, it's a tight squeeze. But thanks to our series, America the Kind, we now know that there's one train conductor out there who tries to make things just a little bit better.
And he was like, come on, we don't have room, but we're going to make it work, and we're all a team, and he just had such good spirits about it.
Every day, Crystal Vanderboom takes the Caltrain from San Francisco to Palo Alto. And this conductor, he stuck out to her.
I saw him several times on the train and already noticed that he was always joyful, thankful. Just by his like whole demeanor, attitude, makes a difference.
So Crystal nominated him for America the Kind. And she had never properly thanked him before. In fact, she didn't even know his name. Well, the Takeaway tracked him down. And with the help of Caltrain, we found out Crystal's mystery conductor is one Lee Guillory. And let's just say it's a call he never expected to get.
I was wondering if I was going to get in trouble at my company.
We're sorry.
No, I had no idea what was it in detail. I was approached, said that someone wanted to speak with me. And I asked my superiors what was it about. They were very vague, really didn't have any information until up to about maybe a couple of hours ago that I got an idea of what was happening. I'm in awe, really. I'm very in awe, and I'm thankful for you. I'm very thankful for you, Crystal. I really appreciate the compliments and the kudos.
Crystal, what are you, now that you're connected with Lee, you know his name, you know that he's a real person here, do you have anything you want to say to him?
Well, it sounds like he was worried for a little bit, so I'm sorry for that. And just how you just responded, you know, you're saying you're thankful. That's just so you. And yeah, you're seen. I think there's many other commuters as well who appreciate you. And I want to see you in person again. I keep missing you. I keep taking different trains. And
I'm on train 319 every morning, 319 going northbound to San Francisco. And I'm on train 232 coming southbound early in the morning. And I appreciate, and I do remember the exact day the incident that took place, where we had a miscommunication and we had not enough bike cars on the train. And I remember that day specifically. And yes, it was very hectic, but I thank all of you guys and girls for riding Caltrain. Without you, there is no us. And I try to make everybody ride pleasant and comfortable for everyone. And I do look at everyone in the eye and I thank them for riding our service, because without the public riding Caltrain, there would be no Caltrain. So I thank you, Crystal, for recognizing me. And thank you for putting up for that unfortunate incident. And I apologize profusely again today for that incident. Hopefully you won't have to deal with such an incident again in the future.
Well, I just want to say, see what I mean?
No, I really do. And I'm starting to get all misty-eyed over here because I can't believe we're talking about transportation. I was going to say, what impact does it have on you when you're commuting? Because commuting can be pretty not fun, right?
Exactly. And so he really, just by his like whole demeanor, attitude, makes a difference. He looks at people, he appreciates people. And that really makes a difference, sets the tone for the rest of my day. It reminds me to smile too.
That's a good point. Lee, how long have you been a train conductor?
I've been with the railroad almost 28 years now. I've been over here in Caltrain for 20 years and dealing with the public through different positions that I've had here. The most pleasant one that I've received my most gratitude from is dealing with the public, because with the public, I look at them as me and my family riding, and I want it to be a comfortable experience. Being in the Bay Area, it's a melting pot for tourists and sightseers, and people have a hard time adjusting to the confusion of riding public transportation and navigating through that. And so helping the public ride our service and making it a pleasant experience rather than an uncomfortable experience make them want to come back. And we welcome everybody out here to Caltrain.
Crystal, in terms of specific times that Lee's kindness really stood out to you, do you recall, I mean, you mentioned the one time with the bike storage, but I'm thinking, was there a time when just the fact that he was there kind of changed your day?
Oh, yeah. Every time I'm on a train that he's the conductor on, I'm like, I smile. And, you know, there's days where I remember him standing there. You know, he doesn't get back on the train until he's thanked everyone that got off. And it's just such a great start of the day. So I get off in Palo Alto and I get on in San Francisco. And yeah, when I get off, I get back on my bike and it's just so nice. I always want to say thank you back. I'm not sure if he ever has heard me, but.
Well, he hears you now, Trissel.
Yeah.
That we know.
Yeah.
Lee, do you realize that you are such a source of kindness in your writers' lives, especially in Crystal's life? Had you had any idea?
Not really, to the extent that this is. I look at it, I try to make everybody's life a little bit more pleasant because we all deal with adversity from whatever means throughout our day, home life. And I feel if I could bring just one little bit of kindness into someone's life, that will set the tone for the day and for the ridership, because we have to deal with a lot of things on the train. And if I can make all our passengers happy once they see a happy face, a happy smile, that changes the whole tone for my interaction with my train and with the passengers that are out here. And if we bring kindness and happiness to the world, we could change about one smile at a time, the way I look at it.
That's what you're doing.
Lee, Crystal, thank you so, so much. And I hope you both keep spreading kindness. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Crystal. Hope to see you soon one day.
Yeah, I want to give you a hug, Lee. See you soon.
I will accept that. Thank you, Crystal.
Okay.
You can see a photo of Lee Guillory on his train at our website, thetakeaway.org/AmericaTheKind. And if you've enjoyed hearing the stories in our America the Kind series, be sure to tune in to The Takeaway on Christmas Day. That's when we'll have a whole hour on kindness, including why humans have literally evolved to be kind.
Human beings are extremely vulnerable. We have an uncertain environment. And if you think back to when we were cavemen, if you're a caveman, you don't know, is there a famine around the next corner? Is there a flood or a natural disaster? And so your world is uncertain. You have to buffer yourselves. When times are good, when you've got plenty, if you've got more than you need, sharing it is going to make you feel good, because now you know, this person owes me, this person owes me, this person owes me. And then when the bad thing happens, you don't see it coming, and you want to be able to draw on that. You are much better as part of a group of people who all are interrelated and owed each other than on your own. If you're just aggressive, then no one's going to come to your aid.
You can hear more from evolutionary biologist Jay Phelan, as well as some of our favorite stories from America the Kind during a special takeaway hour all about kindness on Christmas Day. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.